Okay. Ah, but forget about tzreifa. It's a very unusual punishment, okay? Very
unusual. Tzreifa.
It's not given out every day in the week. Okay, here, do we have a new one?
We're rolling.
Yeah, okay. All right, now, this was the opinion that of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, and as I said, he derives it from putting the stress on the word lo. It has to be a punishment that's applicable to him, but his own children would not be involved. So, malchus you can give to him, right, but it would not be a reflection upon his children. Whereas, if you would say that he is a cholo, that already would punish his children as well, and we can't do that. Bar Poda Omer Kal Vachomer. Now, Bar Poda says, hey, I can figure it out logically. Remember, Kal Vachomer means that by reasoning I can come to a conclusion. All right, what is the Kal Vachomer? He says, Ma Mechalel Inu Mischalel, just as the person who makes the other one, in other words, the this witness who declares, you know, that okay, no, hold it. A mechalel over here is a kohen who marries a gerusha or chalutza. Okay,
right. Okay.
All right. Now, what is the din concerning him?
Can he officiate
as a kohen or not?
No, not at all.
Truth of the matter is that while he would not be acceptable, but nevertheless, any service that he performs is absolutely considered valid. Okay? It is considered valid. Such a kind could still go up and duchen. It would not be considered, you know, a reflection. Okay? Such a kohen could, let's say, in the Beis HaMikdash, if he were to perform a sacrifice, any of the sacrificial duties of the kohanim, then in that case we do not say that the fact what he did, you know, to marry a gerusha or chalutza invalidates his service. On the contrary, his service is still considered a valid sacrificial service. Okay?
So
he is a mechalel. He causes his child to become a cholo, right? But nevertheless, einom is chalel. At the same time, he himself is not declared invalid as a kohen.
Where does the restriction come in then?
Well, if
the
you were a kohen,
would be, okay.
If you were a kohen and your children should be kohen, then that's a very bad penalty.
Right.
First of all, the child is suffering.
This is true. That's number one.
All right. You don't want the child to suffer, but he committed the transgression.
Absolutely right.
Who committed the transgression when they married him? Unless they didn't know the facts.
They
would be involved with the same penalty?
Technically, the answer would be yes. I mean, a rabbi is supposed to know, for example.
Not married.
Huh?
They're supposed to not marry.
Right, the rabbi is not supposed to marry them because he's contravening, you know, a commandment in the Torah that says.
We have that now. The rabbi should know the facts.
Yes, I agree with you, Sam.
The Orthodox
rabbi would be careful not to, but I can't say the same, you know, for
if
the conservative, certainly
you,
not before Brown.
No, you. If someone said to you, your children are not allowed to be American citizens.
I'm not arguing that point. I'm arguing the point that he committed the transgression and he still functions as a Kohen. Where's the penalty?
If someone says you betrayed the country and therefore your children are not allowed to be American citizens.
I'm not arguing that. If I betrayed the country, then I should go to jail.
Okay, but if the. Okay.
No, he's not,
fine.
He's not
that's what I'm saying.
Fine. But this is a different.
That's what I'm saying. He should. Where's the penalty to the Kohen who committed the transgression? If he can function as a Kohen and everything he says is valid, where's the transgression?
He doesn't have to worry about doing the transgression.
Yeah, why worry about it?
We have the series of laws for the prohibited marriages, and also right next to it, you know, is the idea that if a Kohen has a blemish, he can't, a physical blemish, he can't offer the carbonate.
Right.
But yet here, I was stunned to hear this, because it doesn't spell it out in the Tanakh. Actually, Rashi even doesn't say it. I mean, the issue is left unspoken.
You're absolutely right.
A silent issue that the Kohen is actually about to do the carbonate.
Do they cover where the Kohen would be ignorant of the fact.
Well, if he's ignorant,
that he didn't know.
Right, he didn't know. Then that particular
case. Then he'd be innocent.
Right. He would be innocent, and in that particular case, retroactively, it might be considered valid. I say it might be. But, okay, I have to add one other thing, however.
Yeah.
We've learned the Gemara condition. And we know, that Kohanim, if you remember, they tried to be very, very careful about the Yichus.
Right.
To make sure that, they were truly of a priestly family and so on and so forth, okay? So, the truth of the matter is that in the Beis HaMikdash, they had what they called lists, let's say, of those families that were considered kosher l'kahuna, right? That they were valid in order to perform the various functions of kahana. And if somebody was not on the list, then they could question his ability. Now, what would it mean? It would mean that he would not go up to perform the service. Okay? But nevertheless, even coming back to what you said, where we learned, about, that was Parshem, by the way, about, the mum, that a Kohen who has a physical blemish is not allowed to officiate. But it does not disqualify him from the other things of Kohuna. Right, as for example, he could come to the Beis HaMikdash and partake of the various sacrifices that let's say were served subsequently after the sacrifice, so it could be served to the Kohen. Okay,
right.
So in that particular case, even though he had nothing to do with the sacrifice itself, but still he was entitled to
Truma,
this is what is good. Right, Truma is another example that he would be, or challah that you could give to him, the dough that belonged to him, okay, as a Kohen. So in this case, he was not disqualified. And of course, the Kohen was a Baal Mum, this did not transfer to any offspring that he had, because it's only a physical damage to himself.
Yeah.
So that the next generation could be killed. But a Cholol, this is already a blemish that stayed with the next generation, unfortunately. Okay? But nevertheless, even a Cholol, there's a question as to whether, if he performed his service, it is valid or not. And technically, it would be valid. B'diyevet. To begin with, he shouldn't, but if he did it, then it is. Okay. And there's many other cases. For example, we talked about a physical move.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that if the community knows this person very well, and they like this person, then in that case, the community could overlook, come on in, Mort. Yes, I know. August and Stutt, yes. So, in this case, the community could overlook the blemish and still, enjoy the services of the Kohen. So that,
But there's a deen here. I don't understand. Both of these things I don't understand. The Ben Halal could make a karban, and that would be permitted?
If, let's say he did it, people didn't know. Coming back to what Sam said before, okay? All right, would we therefore disqualify him? Yeah, hi, Bart. Grab a seat.
We're really dealing now here with the witnesses.
Right.
But the other areas about...
Right, but in order to understand the Gemara, have to understand every little nuance that we have over here.
Yes. David wanted to say something.
Want to say something if you still don't think he's punished enough.
Yeah. I don't think he's punished enough.
All right, okay. Then... You're saying that he should be punished because he broke the rules.
He should not be allowed to officiate.
Okay, fine. So what rules is he allowed to break? If he steals a sheep, would he be allowed to officiate?
I don't know.
Should he be?
I have no idea.
If he repays the sheep, or the five sheep, whatever it is, would he be allowed to officiate? Should he lose his privilege as a Kohen?
I don't know.
Where do you draw the line? And what crime does he have to commit to lose his rights as a Kohen?
I don't know.
Okay, now take another look at it. Supposing the guy is living in a big community, there's 400 Kohenim, they won't need me, he falls in love with a girl.
Right.
Should I marry her? No, I shouldn't because I won't be a Kohen. But look, there's 399 other Kohenim here, I love the girl, I'm willing to give up my privileges.
What kind of girl is she?
Would you be quiet,
Fiora? No, you have to be specific.
He wants to marry a divorced woman. Like the King of England. The King of England. If the King of England is willing to marry a divorced woman and give up, then surely a Kohen, if he knows that it's for...
But he gave up.
I'm trying to finish, please. He asked me to speak. I didn't volunteer.
You were dying to speak.
I was willing to let the class continue. If the guy says, I love the woman, I'm willing to give it up, fine. And then later on, heaven forbid, they need a Kohen, because the 399 other Kohenim, they, heaven forbid, were caught in a plane crash. Okay, so now you need a Kohen. Why should you disqualify him? He's a Kohen. His father was a Kohen. He's a Kohen. But his children, obviously, you can't have, because they are born of an illicit marriage. So you can't let the children be, but him you can be.
But you see, I see it the other way around. You're punishing the children.
Well, the children.
You're punishing the children for something that had nothing to do with.
The children aren't even born yet.
Wrong when
he knew when he was going to get married that this was the condition. When I marry this divorced woman, I know that my son is not going to be the King of England.
Okay.
That's it.
I would add one other thing, too.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. You know, the cholol is not the same as a mamzer. Okay.
I understand that.
Because a cholol, for example, can marry a Yisraeli or something like that. An ordinary Jewish girl and so on. The only thing is, he would not be welcome to marry a Kohen and so on. Whereas the mamzer, unfortunately, he can't marry into the community. He would have to find the mamzer.
At the time of the crime, the children don't exist.
Yeah.
The children are born after the crime, so how can you punish things that don't exist? You can't call it punishing the children, because the children don't even exist when the crime is committed.
I think it's begging the question.
What do you mean begging the question?
Yes, it is.
All right,
yes.
But anyway, I went into the technicalities over here, because we have to understand when it says, right, the person, you know, this Kohen, who made his own offspring into Chalolim, yet at the same time he is not declared a Cholol himself, right? Mm-hmm. So, Abol Chalel, when this Eid Zomim comes along, of course it's Eidim, remember that when I say Eid, in reality you will have to have it two.
Two, right.
For an agreement, okay? They come along, and, you know, they want to declare that, you know, this person whom they are accusing falsely is a Cholol, right? This is what it means. Abola Khalil, right? Below Khilil. But nevertheless, what happened? When the second set of witnesses came along and said that they're a bunch of liars.
Right.
So that therefore that person, the Cain whom they accused, is not a Cholol, right? So he says, Abola Khalil, but no din. So then if a person comes, you know, this aide who comes, the liberate, who said, yet below Khilil. But he wasn't able to effect it because he was accused of being a false witness. So Eino Din, then, shouldn't it be logical, Shelo Yischalel, that this Eid Zomim does not become a Cholol? Because the other guy was never a Cholol, so he couldn't be a Cholol. So that therefore what? So he says, on the basis of my logic, then I say, okay, so you should get Malkus, but, you know, it's logical. It's not that I need a Pasuk for it. So Matzkefla Rabbeinu didn't like this logic. He says, look, it's not logical. Why? He says, in Cain, but Talta Teo Zevim Zevim. Because when you say, you know, on the basis of logic that he's not an Eid Zomim, I tell you that what you're doing is to destroy this whole idea, you know, of Eidim Zomimin and the penalty that they should suffer. Now, they give another example.
Lost me completely on this. The argument was that the false witness, I thought I understood this, the false witness who comes and says that the Kohen is a halal. All right, so they're saying that because the Kohen, I thought I heard you say that because it's proof that the Kohen is not a halal, that what happens to the witness? Maybe I didn't
get Malkus.
He gets Malkus. That's going to be his punishment.
So
but we say, ain't no Miss Halel. Look, if he didn't make the other guy a Halel, his testimony was proven to be false.
Right.
Right? So therefore, how could he be declared a Halel? In other words, a Ben Grusha Ben Chalutz. Obviously, you can't declare him that. You understand?
Well,
so that therefore, we said before, so what does he get? He gets Malkus instead, right? But you cannot make him into a Ben Grusha Ben Chalutz. Okay?
Well, I'll let that aside for this time.
But Rabino objects. He says, look, with your kind of logic, there'll never be any occasion to have what? Edom Zomim, because if they're not going to get the penalty that they should deserve, then in that case,
it doesn't hold water.
The whole thing, right?
Because you have to judge their punishment by their intent, not by their success.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yes. Not only that, but now we come to a very difficult statement, and that is Umah Sokel, Eino Nisko. He says, if we're going to apply logic, so here we have an even more difficult case. Let's say that these witnesses come along, they testify against a person, okay? The false witnesses. Right, they testify, right? That he has committed a sin for which he deserves the penalty of skila, stoning.
Okay?
Yeah. Not only that, but you know, the Torah is even specific as to who has to throw the first stone. It says, Yad ho'edim tiyebo barishon ala hamisal. That the witnesses themselves have to be the first one to, you know, to throw the stones, the first stone. You understand?
Mm-hmm. That's where the Christians got it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they borrowed from everybody.
Excuse me, I've got a vague recollection of Spin Cheder when they were talking about stoning. It's something about you push the man up the cliff and then you throw a boulder on top of him. Is that familiar to you, or am I mixing up different things?
Yes.
Is that the same? Is that also stoning?
Correct.
But here we're talking about the person throwing the first stone.
Is
it the same method?
Yeah.
You push the man off the cliff.
Yeah, right.
And then the first person to throw the stone.
Yeah, it's not off the cliff. It could be from a roof.
Okay, but you push
like
him.
Right. From a high place. Yeah.
From a high place.
Right.
So the witnesses would be the ones who push him then. Probably.
Right.
And then the witnesses would throw.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. I mean, if they condemn, then they're the ones who have to be willing to do it. You see.
Carry out the punishment.
And they give him a drug first or something?
Well, that's already a different story. Yes, he could be given wine or something like that in order, you know, to ease the pain and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we're not to get too, but make it too horrific. But what exactly is the mode of execution of stoning? I always envisioned that it was...
You simply stoned and people threw stones on you?
Right, but that isn't it at all.
No,
what is it then?
No. So what David said is right. I mean, that he has to... they put him on a platform or something like that, and then they throw him down. And then people throw the stones on him.
But they throw big rocks, big boulders on him? They don't throw...
They throw whatever they have.
So they could roll a boulder over the cliff onto him, or they could throw...
Yeah. I don't know why you like cliffs, but...
I'm telling you stuff from 30, 40 years ago. I've got these vague recollections, so...
Okay.
You should have come to my cheder, you see.
Well, I see. But your rabbi really friendly.
No.
He says, if you don't behave, you're going to get.
All right. We're right.
Okay.
So
let's at least finish. Right. Okay. Now, the difficulty comes in now. Mm-hmm. That they, as a result of their testimony, they condemned this person to death, and the person was put to death.
Uh-huh.
Now we're talking where, you know, actually the the person was put to death. Okay. Now, what happens when witnesses come along after the execution? You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And they say that these guys were false witnesses. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do? So the answer is, in that particular case, you cannot stone them to death. They don't get the same penalty. Mm-hmm. They know Nisko, right? Why? This is already a different story. And I'll be honest with you, it's a difficult concept as far as I'm concerned, okay? But we'll come to it in another few pages, Mi'otza Hashem, and we'll discuss it in greater length at that point. But right now, this is what we're learning, that if after the execution, then they were first accused of being Edom Zomimin, so Eino Nisko, they do not get this penalty. So therefore, Habol is called below Sokal. If this person came and he wanted to, you know, have the penalty of skill inflicted upon, you know, the person whom he accused, and then, you know, he was proved to be an Eid Zomim, and the guy was not stoned to death, that is, you know, the person who was accused, right? Then in that case, he says, Einu Din Shelo Yisokel, right? So in that case, we would say then that he doesn't deserve the death penalty either, there's these false witnesses. Whereas what? Whereas technically they do deserve it, right? So therefore, on the basis of logic alone, he says, I don't like yours because you can prove with logic this, you can prove that. So instead, Elamachobra thought, but we have to say clearly that the reason why he does not become a cholol, getting back to the original one, you know, to the original case, why it does not become a cholol is, as Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, namely that the Torah says, Vasisem lo, that you can do it to him, but you cannot do it to his descendants. You can't make them into cholol. Okay. Kedushinim and Ikora, as we learned at first. Now, the same thing, we'll go a couple of more lines yet, as we're gathering over here. Meyidinon and Beishplein Yishuchayab Golos. You know, the rest of the Mishnah was that we testify against someone that, you know, he committed manslaughter, right, and he deserves to be sent into exile. So it says we do not send these false witnesses into exile as a punishment. But instead we give them Malkus. So he says, Benohani Mile, where in the Torah do we find a reference to this? So Omar Reish Lakish says, Omar Kral, it's a Pasuk that says specifically what? Hu Yonus El Achas Heorim. He shall flee to one of these cities. In other words, you know, to the city of refuge. And what does he lay the stress on? He lays the stress upon who? He. In other words, he is the one. But below Zimmerman, nobody says that, you know, they're going into the city of exile. Rabbi Yochanan Omer Kal V'Chomer. Rabbi Yochanan says, hey, I can prove it logically. Why? Mahu shows a matzah b'mezit. Einu gole. So, just as he, namely the person who committed murder, right, if he did so willfully, right, in other words, if he murdered a person willfully, then in that case he does not go into Golis. Torah says no. I mean, he has to be given the death penalty instead. He has to be judged and found guilty and so on, right? But he doesn't go into the city of refuge. So if that's the case, they who did not, you know, commit a murder deliberately, okay, so Eino Din, then logically, Shelo Yiglu, right, that they should not go into Golis. So what penalty do we have to give them? So as we learned, we have to give them Malkus. And he says, well, he knows sentence. And this, can be explained on the logical basis, namely, who shows a Masa B'mezid Lo Ligle? Why did he, that is the murderer, who murdered somebody willfully, right, and yet he doesn't get golas? Why? For the reason that kiheche de lo sehevu le kapora, for the reason that golas is an atonement for sin. So kapora. Kapora here means, you know, that as a result of suffering, so, it takes away some of the horror that you did. It should arouse you to thoughts of tshuva all the rest of your life, you understand, right? So, just as a murderer doesn't have that, because he did it deliberately, and therefore he cannot go into Golis and receive the kapora, to receive the atonement that would come through it, so hein shalei osu masa b'mezid, they who did not, you know, commit a murder deliberately, so not me, Liglu. So they, yes, should get Golus, as we learned, right? They should, but they don't, right? But they should, he says, logically get Golus. So that they could
also
reflect over there. If they're in Golus in the city, then they'll have plenty of years in which to, to atone for what they tried to do to him. So, that being the case, nevertheless, the Mishnah says no, they don't get that penalty, they don't get that break, so to speak, that they get immediately a kapara. Instead, they have to work it out. Why? But rather, we see that the Gemara, that, it's as Reish Lakish said, namely, who? He is the one, but not the Edom Zomim. Instead, as we said, their penalty is Malkus, so that they'll have a good lesson and have a chance, you know, to feel immediately the pain that they wanted to inflict upon this person who was innocent. Okay, we'll stop at this point because it's time to daven mincha, so we'll say Rabbi Hanani ben Kash Omer. Of course, Omer Beis of Daf Beis, right, yeah, okay. And, we start this evening with Omar Ula. Okay, you see where that is? It's roughly about 10 lines down.
Omar Ula, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, Levin has a little asterisk over there.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, see where the asterisk is? Good. Amar Ula. Ula said, Remez Leidim Zominatoy Minayim. He says, where do we have like a hint about the law of Edom Zomimin in the Torah? Now, we have to explain. I mean, the word Remez normally means that, you know, there's only, it's hinted at, but it's not stated specifically in the Torah. Now, if that's the case, immediately there's going to be an objection. Because the objection is, Edom Zomimin is written in the Torah. So what are you talking about a Remez, right? So, Remez Leidim Zomimin, that's exactly what they say. Remez Leidim Zomimin, you are asking, you know, where is it hinted that there is such a thing as Edom Zomimin and what should be the punishment? It's written specifically in the Torah, Va'asisem lo, that you shall do unto him kasher zomam, just as he proposed, you know, to do to the person against whom he testified. Of course, when I say he, naturally, and normally, I'm thinking, of course, in terms of the pair, because, you know, you have to have at least two witnesses in order to affect anything. Although, a little bit later today, maybe we get to a point where we see that sometimes one witness may be involved and the other one not particularly. But it's only under certain special circumstances, okay? So, at any rate, it's written, Va'asisem lo kasher zomam. Can there be anything more, you know, specific than that? That the Torah says you shall do to him even as he proposed to do to the person, you know, against whom he came and he gave false testimony? So they say, Elo remez leidim zomim shelokim in HaTorah. But they say, where do we have a hint in the Torah that Edom Zomimim can get the punishment of Malkos? And of course, what are we talking about, the punishment of Malkos? We're talking about, you know, in a case where the original punishment that would have been inflicted upon the person who was accused was different than Malkos. And in these specific inyonim, these specific instances, the Chachamim come along and they say that the Edom Zomimin, when they are challenged and so on, and they have to get punishment, but the punishment is not Kasher Zoma, which it should have been according to the law of the Torah, but instead they get Malkus instead as their punishment. So, Minayin, where do we derive that? Where is there a hint upon that? So they say, Dechsev, we have the following succession of psukim. It's written, the Hitzdiku es Hatzadik. Now, of course, technically in the Torah, who are they talking about? Talking about the Dayanim, okay? The judges, okay? Then what does the Beis Din have to do? The Hitzdiku es Hatzadik. They have to declare that the person who is righteous is righteous. In other words, they have to give a verdict in favor of the person who is righteous and say he's the right one, right? The Yeshua is HaRosha, and at the same time they have to condemn the Rosha, right? And then the next pasuk says, V'hoya im bin hakos HaRosha, and it shall come to pass if the Rosha deserves to be flogged, right? So they say, why do we have this sequence of verses? Because, you know, one follows exactly upon the other. So the answer is, Mishum v'hitzdiku es hatzadik v'yoshua es harosha v'yom bin hakeis harosha. Are we to say that because of the fact that the tzadikim, that is, that the judges, you know, have to declare righteous the person who is innocent, and they have to declare the people who are wicked, and therefore they deserve the punishment, and therefore immediately that if the person who is wicked deserves, you know, to get Malkus, so it doesn't work out. Why won't it work out? It won't work out because, I mean, there are many other penalties that can be given, you know, by the Beis Din. So why the succession? So this time they turned it around. Instead of referring it to whom? To the Dayonim, to the judges, right? They say, no, let's refer it instead to the Edim, to the witnesses. So they say, Elo Edim Shirishiva Satzadik. But rather, you know, let's refer this case to witnesses who declared a person who was righteous, and they declared that he was a Rasha, right? They also ate a machrine, and then along came another set of witnesses, the Yitzdiku as a tzaddik, and what did they do? They restored the righteousness of the tzaddik. In other words, they proved, you know, by their testimony that the person who was originally, he was a defendant, so to speak, right, was really correct, right, he was right. So, in that particular case, the Hoyam bin Hakos HaRosha. So, in that case, we say, okay, then witnesses who bring false testimony should get Malkos. So, now they ask another question. The question that they ask is, reciprocally, Leisan, there, look, we have a general principle. First of all, what is Lo Saneh? This we know. This is part of the Ten Commandments, right? What does it say? Lo Saneh v'yachol e'chaka, right? You're not allowed to bear false witness against your neighbor. Okay? It's written. And we have a general principle that chayavei lavin lokin, or malkin or some. In other words, people violated a negative command in the Torah, then in that case, what do? They get Malkus as their punishment. That's a general rule. But now, along comes, letter A down below, footnote A, and to say that, hey, wait a minute, doesn't hold true in every single case. Why? Because it says, Mishum de'hevei lav she'en b'matzeh. This, lo saneh, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor, he says, this is a negative command, but there is no actual performance of something. There's no act, actually, that's involved in it. Just he's saying things. And saying things is not enough in order to justify, to give him the punishment of Malkus. Okay? So, Mishum de Habilab Shein B'Maaseh, right?
Excuse me, that means if I do something wrong, if I say something against my father,
yes,
I'm speaking with my mouth, does that mean that I can get away with it?
Yeah, what it means is that the Beis Din cannot inflict punishment upon you for doing that. But it doesn't make it, therefore, you understand?
Okay.
The Beis Din does not have the authority to punish you for making bad statements against your father, okay? But morally, you're still wrong. There's no question.
Okay, but it's not a negative commandment where I would get Marcus. You're saying because I'm speaking, it's not...
There is no maser. In other words, there is no actual. A physical deed, so to speak, that is involved.
So speech
in it.
Is not considered a.
Speech is not. Okay. Look, I understand. I mean, as far as we're concerned, speech could be very harmful. And I don't have to tell you that there are pages and pages in the Gemara about the evils of lashon hara, for example.
But
okay.
What about the person who talks to someone else to get him to worship something else? That is not.
That's already a different story. That's a Macy's Solomadia. Okay, that's an exception. That's an exception.
There are exceptions where speech will lead to Malkus, where it's specifically ordained. It just means that it doesn't. You can't use the general application of Malkus to the Los Sasei. If it's
Los Sasei Shiach. Right, Shaim Bo, right. It's exactly what the story is. There would have to be, look.
Sorry.
Torah, for example, says you're not allowed to strike your father or your mother, right? Okay. All right. So, it says that, and then what do you do with that? There you have actually a matzah that's involved, right?
Right.
Okay. So then along comes the chazal, and by the way, what is the punishment the Torah says? It says death, right? Makei ove v'yimo mos yumos, okay?
Fine.
Yeah,
fine.
And then after that it says Ubukalil Ovi Vimo Mos Yumas, okay? If he curses his father and his mother also, he deserves the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But will the death penalty actually be inflicted upon him? This is already a different story. Mm-hmm. You understand? For example, in the first case that I mentioned, in order for him to get the death penalty, one of the first conditions has to be that Osabahem Bhaburo Khabola, in other words that he's actually hit them in such a way, that it causes, permanent damage
or welt,
to them.
Or welt. Or
welts, whatever it may be. I mean, you could see.
Right.
And so that if, he would do that, then he would be deserving of death. But if, you know, simply, let's say, slap their face, which was a terrible thing to do in any case, but, you know, nothing further developed except, let's say, momentary pain and anguish or something like that. So for that, the Beis Din cannot condemn him to death. There has to be a mitzvah that's involved. So that speech by itself is not considered, you know, damaging. But as I say, that's only in this particular context. Because the Gemara has several pages of, you know, where it inveighs against Lashon Hara. And it compares the Lashon, you know, the person who spreads Lashon Hara to like a poisonous snake. Because he bites, or like to a murderer. They say he's a murderer because why? He murders the reputation of the person against, you know, whom he is slandering. Understand? So in that case, I mean, there is such a thing as morally wrong, and there is such a thing as, shall we say, whether a person is legally liable to punishment. So here, this is what they're stressing about the fact. Yes. Well, that's already going into a very gray area, okay? Yeah, splitting hairs, exactly. Obviously, even if the community is aware, it's a matter of, you know, it's not nice to go and talk against somebody. Unless, you know, the actions of that person are going to prove so detrimental or so dangerous to the community, you understand?
Well,
then in that case, I mean, there's a different story.
For instance, if you're doing something or to alleviate something that might go against the community, that's what you mean, might be a different story.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, if what that person is doing is 100% detrimental to the community, then in that case, the community has, you know, a right to protect itself, okay? But, you know, just to go and to repeat slanderous tales or vicious tales, even if there is a basis of truth in what they have to say, it's not something that morally should be encouraged, okay? Be very nice about it. But we all know that unfortunately, you know, everybody has a tendency to talk about other people, okay? You know, in Yiddish you have two different verbs, right? One verb is reden, right? And then you have bari. Right.
Yeah.
Talk about bari means that you talk against somebody, and that, you know, that already implies, you know, something vicious is involved in it. So reden is one thing, but bari is that's a lot worse. So.
Right. I haven't heard that word in years.
Yeah, no. I used a lot of Yiddish today in the eulogy. Because I felt she was a Yiddish man.
She
and,
was.
Yeah, Arlene knows Yiddish quite
she
well.
She knows. Yeah.
Okay. So, we have now a general principle that says, V'chol lav she'en boi ma'ase, and then ein lo k'no lav. All right. So, therefore, what is the proof? It proves that le'sana b'riacho eit shoker, right? That this by itself would not be a hint that, you know, if a person is an eid zoymim, that he should automatically get malchus. Okay. Tana Rabbanan. So now they bring in the Baraisa. Actually, it comes from, it's a Baraisa. Okay. And it says as follows. It says, there are four things that have been said concerning Edim Zomimin. What do you mean, four things?
What does Zomimin mean?
Okay, Zomimin, the verb itself means that you intend to do something to somebody else. That's what the verb means, okay?
The witness intends to do it? Is that it?
The witness intends to do harm to the person against whom they are bringing false witness. Okay? The verb is derived from the pasuk in the Torah, which says "Va'asisem lo," you shall do unto him, meaning unto these false witnesses, right? "Kasher zomam lasos li'ochim," just as he proposed, you know, his purpose was okay to do to the other one.
Yeah.
Let's say that, for example, you know, these witnesses came and testified falsely that so-and-so, let's say, stole money. Okay? Then in that case, what should be the punishment of the Eitz Omim? That's the money. Don't forget, in Jewish law, it's the law of the Torah, stealing, ganeva, right, is quite a different proposition. That is, the punishment for ganeva is different than the punishment that we have in civil law, in American law. Okay? In American civil law, if somebody is a ganav, what do? You try to arrest them and send them to jail. Okay? All right. The law of the Torah, however, doesn't work that way. The use of a jail was very seldom. Occasionally they had. But by and large, in the case of a ganav, for example, the feeling was that the ganav has to pay back what he has stolen from the person whom he has harmed. Okay?
Does he have to pay back more than
that? All right. Now that's already another bison. And that is that also the Torah specifies that in most cases he has to pay back double. That's in order to discourage him, you know, from stealing. Okay? And, you know, so it's, you know, called about passion. Shem argues, all right, Elohim Yoved Vashtehem, right? So it has to be brought before the Bezdin. Asher Yashayun Elohim, right? And if the Bezdin declare that he is a Russian, in other words, they say that he is guilty, Taka, of having done it, then Yishalim Shnayim Reyehu. He has to pay back double the amount of the person, obviously the person from whom he stole. Okay? So that the idea is make him pay restitution. Now we'll come to that a little bit further on over here, where they deal also when what happens, let's say if the Ganav squandered everything and he doesn't have what to pay, then what do you do to him?
Slavery.
He could be sold into slavery. That's the answer. Okay? So we'll come to that in a moment.
But they didn't put him in jail, though.
They didn't put him into jail. Jail could be, let's say, used for a temporary reason, or in some penalties where it was impossible to convict because he didn't have two witnesses who actually saw it, but nevertheless, there is a very strong presumption of guilt. And in that case, they might put him into a place that they called Akipa.
What would that mean literally?
Kippah is literally, you know, it's like a vault. This is what a kippah is.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Right. This is called a kippah too because it's like vault shaped, okay? Yeah. And of course, the word kippah itself, you recognize, it comes from the word kaf, which means palm, okay? Because of its shape. Yeah. All right. So, at any rate, all right, getting back over here. So now they say that there are four different cases concerning Eidim Zomimim where we learn where the tradition is that they do not get the penalty of Kasher Zoma. In other words, they do not get the same penalty that would have been given to the person against whom they testified. And what are these four cases? Well, the first two we've had a little further up on the page, what we learned last week. The first one is, of course, okay, Eina Sin Ben Grusha Ben Chalutza, right? If they are Kohanim, these Eidim Zomimim, and they testified against a Kohen, saying and they said that this Kohen happens to be the son of a woman who was divorced, but who was a Chalutza, right? In other words, she received Chalitza from her brother-in-law, which, of course, in either case, I mean, the Kohen is not permitted to marry her, but nevertheless, let's say, you know, he lived with her, and he produced a child with her, so this child is automatically considered what? The Cholo, right? So we do not say that these people, these Edom, if they happen to be Kohanim, automatically, you know, they're going to become disqualified, or their sons, their children, right? Their sons are going to become, their children will become disqualified as a result of that. Okay? Instead, we learned, you know, what do? They get Malkus as their punishment. All right. So that's case number one.
They get flogged.
Right. They get flogged, correct. And why? Because it boils back again to what we said, Vasisem lo, right? And so on and so forth. In other words, the application can only apply to him, but not to any offspring that he has. Okay. So they get flogging as their punishment. So that's case number one that we had above. Case number two that we had before was also, you know, where they come and they say that, you know, so-and-so accidentally killed so-and-so, right? And therefore, what should be his punishment?
He's
going to Golis, as we learned, okay? Because the year, you know, to go into Golis and to hear HaMiklot, this was the punishment if you committed accidental murder, not premeditated murder.
No.
Premeditated murder, it's written, even if you try to find sanctuary in the Beis HaMikdash, he's to be taken away even from the altar. If he's grabbing onto the altar, he's been taken away.
He has no sanctuary.
He has no sanctuary, whatever. Right. Why? Well, we learned before. Why does the person who committed accidental death go into the Ir HaMiklot, goes into Golis? Because it's Kapora. In other words, he should have time to reflect upon the fact that he took a human life, even accidentally. Okay? And therefore, he has to atone for it. And how does he atone for it? He atones through this punishment of Golis. Okay.
But can he eventually get back? Or
yes. Under what circumstances does he get back? The answer is, it's written, when the Kohen Godol passes away, then in that case he can leave his Ir HaMiklot, his Ir Miklato. Okay? So that, and of course, again, you know, the Gemara is going to ask, I mean, why is it so dependent upon the fact that, you know, the Kohen Godol? And the answer is because this Kohen Godol, he should also have prayed to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam that there should not be even manslaughter taking place, right? There should not be, you know, people should be very careful in their relations with other people. So that, to a certain extent, was. And that's why, you know, they have to stay over there in the year Miklot, you know, until such time that the Kohen Gadol passes away. And of course, there's also a practical reason, because as we learned in the Torah, during the time that he should leave his city of refuge.
Yeah.
So there is the Goel Hadom, in other words, a member of the family is entitled to try to seek vengeance against the person, you know, who accidentally killed the other one. Of course, later on we're going to learn in the Gemara that even with accidental murder, they want to know more what are the circumstances. Not everybody who kills accidentally is automatically sent to the Ir HaMiklot. Because certain things are considered, you know, shall we say, like unavoidable, and other things, other circumstances, are things that could have been avoided with a little more care, okay? So, naturally, it's those things that could have been avoided and that he was negligent, you know, in, that would bring about this punishment of God. But at any rate, what do we learn just above? That again, who Yonus, right? He, the person who committed, he is the one who has to flee to the Ir HaMiklot, right? But not who?
Not the
Edom Sedom. So therefore, what do they get? Is their punishment? They get Malkus. All right, so now the Gemara brings two more cases where they get Malkus instead of instead of the punishment that they should have gotten. Okay? What are the other two? So the first one is V'yein Mishalmin Es HaKofer. They did not pay the Kofer. Come back to that in a second. And the fourth one is V'yein Din Korin the Eved Ivri. And the fourth one is that they cannot be sold as an Eved Ivri. Okay? Alright, so now we have to explain both of these. The word Kofer in connection with punishment occurs twice. Parsha Mishpatim. Okay? Case number one involves, well, why don't we take a Chumash over there? Okay. So I'll give you the exact translation. Thank you very much, David. Okay. Okay. Case number one is as follows. Well,
it's okay. You can open to the page for me.
Well, okay, it opened, but the wording is not exactly. It's only the way it's understood. Okay, but the first case involves. It's written over there. that the Chiyonotsu Anoshim, it would be on page 309, okay? Two people have a fight with each other, okay? The dog for Isha Horva Yotsu Lodeha, and one of them happens to hit a pregnant woman with the result that she miscarries, okay? The Lo Yerason means that, you know, she doesn't suffer any other physical harm except the loss of the fetuses, okay? So anyway, it's written over there, Ono Sheyonesh, that he must be punished, even as the husband, the woman, you know, makes demand upon him, right? But also mitlilim, and it has to be done, by the best. Clearly means in this case, judges have to judge, you know, how much the assessment should be and so on. All right. So that's case number one. Then we have another case. Okay? Next case that is mentioned is on the following page.
The assessment is the kofir, is that?
Yeah, okay. Right. In this particular case. But we'll see why it's called kofir. Okay?
All
right. Next case that they mention over here, of course there are other cases, but it's pertinent to our part. Okay, it says, right? If an ox gores a man or a woman, and that person dies, right? Then, okay. Then in that case, literally, it would say, that the person, that is, the ox has to be stoned to death, okay? Its flesh cannot be eaten, right? But it's written, in other words, the owner of the ox, he is free from what? Free from the death penalty, okay? You understand?
Because he didn't do it.
Right. It's his ox who did it, okay?
Yeah,
right. But then it says afterwards, right? And what happens if this ox was, first of all, what we would call a short tom. In other words, tom means that it was not in the habit of goring. It happened only once, it happened twice, best, okay? But what happens if the ox has a history of goring? Okay? That's what the next passage says, okay? It says, V'yimshor nagochu mitmol shalshom. What if the ox, however, has this reputation as being a gorer? When? Yesterday, the day before, in other words, it's already the third time, that it's happened.
A wild ox.
Right, it's the third time. But who are they all of? Not only that, but witnesses have come along and they testify against the owner. They say to him, hey, you got a wild ox over there. You got an ox that gores. The lawyer Shmerenu, and yet he didn't take any precautions, to prevent this from happening. The Hamish is Shoishor. Then I show you Sokol again, the punishment of the ox is to be stoned to death. And here it says, Vagambo love you most, right? And also, his owner is to be put to death. However, the very next verse says, Im Kofer Yushasolov, if Kofer is laid upon him, which here the English translation is a ransom. All right, Rosanna ransom. Okay. So, if a ransom is placed upon him, then in that case, Vinosam Pidyon Navshe, Kecholasha Yushasolov, then he has to pay, literally, for the redemption of his soul, whatever, is imposed upon him to pay. Okay? Now, the very fact that it says, first of all, the gambo love you must, right? That the owner is to be put to death. And then the very next verse says, im kofer yushasolov. So along come our chazal, right, and Gemara Sanhedrin, and they say, this proves what? That the death penalty will never be inflicted upon the man. The ox, okay, the ox you kill, okay, but not the man. Instead, what does he have to do? He has to pay the kofer.
Ransom.
He has to pay the ransom money, whatever it is that the court imposes upon him. Okay.
It's 18 again that imposes.
Yes.
Good heavens.
No? No? Wergeld? The Wergeld?
Wergeld?
For a kofer.
What kind of geld?
Wergeld, but
it's something from old England.
There you go. Wow.
Something like that. I don't know.
Even Shakespeare would recognize the word.
This is Beowulf.
Doesn't that sound familiar?
No, it doesn't anymore. Okay. All right. So, Getting back. All right. So the business of Kofar. Okay. Technically, then, what? If they testify, right, that they testify falsely, that, let's say, Yonkel over there, you know, his ox was a muad, as we said, you know, he had a history testified to, right, by witnesses,
right,
that this was a goring ox and he had killed the person, right? So in that case, the judge says, okay, then you have to pay the kofar, right?
The ransom.
All right, the ransom. Now, what happens if they have proved to be false witnesses? So obviously, the ransom is not going to be paid, right? But should they pay a ransom to him? So we'll see, the answer is no. In this case, they get malchus. Why? We'll see the reason why.
And do you let the ox survive?
Yeah, I guess if you haven't put it to death. If you prove in the court of law that it's not so, then okay, so
you have to keep the ox alive until,
right,
alive till after the trial.
Right. Well, what would happen if the ox is put to death? And so obviously, you know, the court could assess, you know, monetary punishment upon him, you know, pay you what the owner or something. Yeah.
And
yes.
When they say in Shalmin et a kofar,
right,
the witnesses are not testifying then to the fact that the man did not pay the kofar. They're testifying.
They're testifying to the fact that they saw that this ox, which was declared to be a muad, gored a person to death. Right?
Right.
All right. So that person cannot get the death penalty, as we said.
Right.
Because of the juxtaposition of the two psukim, you know.
Right.
That after the gambo, love you most, and then right next to it, it says, of kofar you shasado. So obviously, this nullifies, you know, the previous one, okay? And but this is what they're testifying.
That's
they're
the
testifying,
rate
right?
Rate
they
rate
claim
the
that this is what
the
they saw exactly.
Behavior.
Exactly, right. Remember,
okay,
we're going to have the Gemara in Sanhedrin also goes into this in detail. Okay. They establish a basic rule, and that is that witnesses, in order to be declared Edom Zomimim, they have to give testimony of the type that it is possible to challenge them on the basis that Imonu Hayisim. Remember that phrase? Imonu Hayisim, the more complaining, right? That you were with us, you know, how can you testify that you saw this and this event happen when you were together with us in this and this place, you know, not the same place, at the time that you claimed that you saw it happen? Okay, and you know, there's a great connection, you know, between the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Gemara over here in Makos, because in the Gemara in Sanhedrin they go into the business about how do you question the witnesses, and there they have in general two basic types of questions that they would ask. Okay, the first one would be Chakiros. Chakiros means where did it happen, when did it happen, in what year, what day of the week, what time in Shemitah did it happen, what Yovel did it happen in, so that, you know, that they know exactly, you know, the time and the place. Pardon me?
Phase of the moon.
Oh, well, that not only is an Eidus HaKadosh. That's only the question of Eidus HaKadosh.
No, that's bogus. No, it was a real case.
I thought it was in the movie.
Wasn't Lincoln defended a case in which he pulled out an almanac,
mm-hmm,
and told the witness that who had claimed to have seen the crime by the full moon that,
mm-hmm,
there was no moon that night? Turned out he was lying.
Abraham Lincoln told a lie?
There really was no moon that night.
I've lost my respect for Abraham Lincoln.
He saved someone's life?
But that happens a lot. You know, since that's the same, what he's saying is very true.
Yeah.
Someone will ask a question like this, holding a blank piece of paper, you know, to intimidate the witnesses. It's a valid cross-examination to teach their credibility.
You have to remember that in general they didn't employ lawyers in those days.
Right.
They had to question the witnesses, and it was on the basis of the testimony of the witnesses, you know, that the judge would come to some decision. The other type of questions that they ask, by the way, those are called drishos. By drishos, it would mean, okay, you say that you saw it happen, let's say, under a tree in the park. What did the tree look like? Understand? Where was the park located? Things like that and so on. Well, I mean, let's say, what was the color of the leaves? Were the leaves falling? Were they green? Were they brown? And so on and so forth. You understand? So, in one type, in Chakiros, a person could never be convicted unless the witnesses, you know, were in absolute agreement on the testimony concerning where, when,
whatever.
Right. But the other, let's say, under what circumstances, you know, what was the background, so to speak, there, if there was a disagreement between witnesses, it might possibly be thrown out of court, or it might be disregarded. Depends, of course, on the nature of the testimony, and, you know, what was involved. You understand?
Right.
Yeah.
And the witnesses, of course, are questioned individually.
Oh, yeah, separately. Yeah. The witnesses were always questioned individually.
Separately.
Always separately, right. One witness would be put into another room altogether where he couldn't hear what was going on, and, you know, witness A would be questioned, and then after that, you know, witness A was brought back to his own private room over there, and witness B was then summoned to the court and questioned. So,
is it always the Av Bet Din or the Rosh Din that did the questioning, or was
well,
any
he could start the question, but the judges all had an opportunity,
right.
It depends, incidentally, by the way, whether it was Dini Nefoshes or whether it was Dini Momenos. In Dini Momenos, the rule is that, you know, the Rosh Beis Din is the one who normally starts, or the Godol, Shabbat Dayon, or something like that.
Right.
Okay? In other words, the most expert judge would start the question. But where Dini Nefoshes was concerned, then they would start, as it says, Minatzad, which means that you would start, you know, not with the most experience and so on, but listen to the others, because they did not want, if there were judges who could find zakus, who could find favor for the person who was being charged, they didn't want them to feel intimidated by the fact that they have other people, you know, who are far more experienced than them. Let them express themselves without fear of intimidation, and then, you know, the Gedolim would speak, because the fear was that if the Gedolim started, then in that case the others would be too abashed, so to speak, you know, to try to differ with those who had preceded them. So it's fascinating. I mean, when you begin to consider, you know, what was the procedure of criminal law and civil law and so on and so forth. Requires a lifetime of study, the members could talk. All right. So getting back over here to our text. Okay. So now we say that, okay. Okay, right. All right. So we say that the Amish Shaman is a kofer. They did not pay the kofer, right, the ransom money. Instead, they would get Malkos, obviously. And finally, the ending coin, the Abedivri. As I said before, the punishment of a Gadif was to pay back, but if he didn't have it, then the Beis Din could sell him as
a slave.
Okay. By the way, since we're talking about an Eved Ivri, talking about a Jew who sold into slavery, in reality, we have to distinguish this case, which is the case that we find in the Torah in Parsha Mishpatim, from the case that we read just this past Shabbos in Parsha Bahar, where it's written over there, you know, that the chiyomucha chicha, right? So, v'nimkar, le'evit, okay? And then it goes into even more over there, because if he sold as a slave, it's one thing to have, let's say, a Jewish master to whom he sells himself as a slave, because he cannot afford to support his family. So he figures that, okay, I can't afford to support my family, I'm too poor, so I'll go to work as an Eved, because then my master will have to take care of me, have to take care of my children, and so my wife, my children, so on.
Now,
okay?
Is that for a certain number of years, is it a certain number of years.
Right. Generally speaking, of course, they are to work for 6 years, I say generally speaking, and then the seventh year they go out free. Okay, this is about Sheish Shanim Yavod, right? But if Yovel, for example, should happen to come earlier, or the year of Shemitah should come, and here there is a difference, I don't want to go into all the technical, okay, but in Yovel, everybody, every Eved goes back free. Whether he was in category A, namely a Ganef who didn't have the wherewithal to pay back, and therefore was sold into slavery for a certain number of years in order to pay back the debt that he owed, right? Or the other case, you know, where a person sold his services as a slave because he couldn't afford to support himself. And of course, I don't have to tell you that, well, as we read in the Torah this past week, the family is obligated to see that the person does not remain a slave. He has to have a goel,
a
redeemer. He has to have redemption, right? Who will pay back, you know, the debt that he owes or whatever it may be, you know. Because usually this is what happened. A person was in debt and he couldn't pay his debts. Okay, so what do you do? Has to work it off. Okay? Not put into a debtor's prison. That was English law. Even American law at one time. Okay? But he had to work it off. So this is the way he worked it off. But if he had a goel,
redeemer.
A redeemer, a member of the family, whatever it may be, then in that particular case, it was a mitzvah for the goel to get him out, that he shouldn't be a slave. And what was even worse is if a person sold himself into slavery to whom? Not to a Jew, but
to a goy.
This was an even worse situation. Because, you know, if he was sold as a Jew, at least the circumstances were such that he could live a fully Jewish life, even as an Eved. There are certain restrictions, but still you know that an Eved is high of b'chol ha-mitzvahs, you know, b'chol mitzvahs le-sasa, right? He is obligated to observe all the negative commandments, and as far as affirmative commandments, he is obliged to observe them, except for mitzvahs asei shazman gromo, except for those that are dependent upon time, because his time belongs to his master. Okay, but you know, if he works for a goy, this is already a greater danger, because he might wind up as an idolater, as a goy, and so on. So you know, you have to get him out.
But the Jubilee year wouldn't apply to him if he worked for a goy.
Yes,
then. It wouldn't apply. Would
it? It would apply, yeah. Provided that the goy was living in Eretz Yisrael.
Oh, right.
Because where does Jubilee year apply? Only in Eretz Yisrael.
That's right. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it not only applies only in Eretz Yisrael, but it applies when Jews are really ruling Eretz Israel. Not like the present Rabin Peretz government, unfortunately. Okay. Now, at any rate, if they come and they say that this person should be sold as a slave, right? Because, you know, he owes and so on and so forth, and then, you know, they prove that this guy, he doesn't. He never incurred the debt that they claim, so can we say that these people should instead, you know, be sold as slaves? The answer is no. They cannot be sold as slaves. Instead, they get malchus for giving this false testimony. Now, Rabbi Akiva adds one more. He says, Rabbi Akiva, Mishum Rabbi Akiva Omru. So, in the name of Rabbi Akiva, they added the following. They said, At ein mishalmin al pi atzman. They do not pay according to their own admission. Now, this is a little complicated. We'll get to it a little bit further on. What does it mean they don't pay according to their own admission? Because it sounds as, you know, as if what he's saying right now is that they do not pay if they confess to the fact that they were Edom Zomim. In that case, they're free from paying the penalty, right? This is what it would seem like. Now, obviously, they can't get off that scot-free. So this requires a little further study when we get down. But now what they do is to analyze these different things that we've said before, because they want to understand more clearly what it is. Okay? So, we'll go in order. First of all, it says, V'ein Mishalmin and Sakofer, right? We've already mentioned before that they don't get Golas, right? And that if they're Kohanim, they're not called, yes, okay. Ein Nasim ben Grusha ben Chalutza, right? Kedam Oren, as we already said, namely, that you know, you cannot penalize you know, this person's children because he tried to penalize you know, this person by claiming that you know he was a chalo, right? The Ein Goylin Lori Amikvah, as we said, Hu Yonus, he's the one, but you know the Edom Zomim don't have that. Kedamoran, why don't they get it? Because as we said before, they don't deserve the kapora. You understand? They don't deserve the kapora. No. That's the reason why they don't get it. Okay? Because if going into Golis is an atonement, these guys who deliberately set out, you know, in order to cause a person to be penalized that way, they don't deserve the privilege of getting kapora. Okay? That's what we said. The aim is Shalman is Hakofer. So, next question is, why don't they pay the kofer, this ransom, right? So, Kasabre, after all, our sages come and they say, you know why? Because Kufra, that is the kofer, if you wish, right? This, they say, is Kapora. As we said before, with the people in the, you know, who deserve, you know, about Golis, right? That this also is not simply a monetary fine, but actually it's meant to be an atonement for you know the criminal behavior in the, you know, in slandering a person and claiming falsely, you know, that he was guilty. The Hani Lab and Ekaporaninu, they don't deserve this, that they should be given the privilege of kapara, right, of atonement. All right. Yes.
The article says that the part, in that case, the kofer is an atonement for the owner's negligence.
Yeah.
And therefore, they wouldn't have to.
Okay.
They wouldn't have to have a kapara.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's the way Rashi understands it. Right. So Rashi understands it that way. Correct. I mean, that's how Artsville got it. Okay.
I'm glad they're not just making.
All right. But, I mean, we can see, in general, a principle that's involved over here. These guys acted, you know, in order to try to condemn a person, so there's no kapora for what they did.
What they did.
Right. Yeah. They have to work it out some other way, okay? All right. I see it's almost time to daven, okay? Honey, love, and a kapora. All right, so. All right, we'll stop at this point, because now they're going to try to determine, you know, who is the author. It's the general principle that we said that kofer, that ransom, is a kapara. Okay? It's not just a monetary fine, but also the person who caused it also, you know, is involved. Okay.
Doctor, yes. Really, to express our admiration of you, all of your students, everyone participated and wanted to give you this. And,
thank you very, very much.
Done.
Thank you. Believe me, I appreciate your feelings, and I'm happy to call you not only Talmidai, but Chaverai as well.
Good.
Baruch Hashem. And we should continue to learn, as next week we will again, 7 o'clock, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
May 24th.
Right. We may not be coming up.
We're on Daf Beis.
Okay, we're on Daf Beis, on the Beis.
On Beis.
Okay. Now, I want to review again a couple of lines that we did last week, and also some Rashis and so on. Okay. And we're in the middle right now. You see where we have the long line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So there, of course, we learned, first of all, a principle that, you know, normally we would say that if a person violates a law in the Torah, then what is his punishment? His punishment would be Malkus. Okay? Unless there is some specific punishment mentioned in the Torah other than that. But this would be the generic punishment, so to speak. But why didn't they accept, for example, the fact that, you know, in the case of Edom Zomimim, after all, aren't they violating Lo Sanibri Achoyet Shoka, that you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor?
Right.
So there we learned then on the long line, it says, that's Mishum Nahavi Lav She'em B'Maaseh, right? Because this is a Lav. In other words, it's a negative command wherein there is no actual deed involved in it. V'chol Lav She'em B'Maaseh in Lokin Olav. And this is a general principle that unless the Lav is associated with an actual act, you see, where, you know, a person actually performed an act against, you know, that, so in that particular case, he's not liable to malchus. I'm not saying that he shouldn't be punished. He deserves punishment. But
does he get punished?
He would not be punished by the court. No. We'll leave it to the Rabbeinu Shalalim to take care of him, you know, when it's time to give him the story.
He did so mean and then gets away with murder.
Not murder. Murder.
But he gets away with telling a lie.
Right, with telling a lie. Exactly. Okay. All right. Then we quoted that Tonu Rabbonim that Dala Devorim Nemru Be'edim Zomimim. There are four things spoken about Edim Zomimim. One of them is Einarsim Ben Gerusho Ben Chalutzo. This we learned, you know, on the first page and then previously, namely that even if they declare, you know, that the Kohen who they are accusing, you know, was the son of a divorced woman or the son of a woman who had received chalitza, nevertheless, we do not say that, you know, if he in turn, let's say, is a Kohen, then, you know, he should be declared. Why? Because in the final analysis, he's not, you see. So, and they based it on the idea that lo, right, below zara. In other words, the Eid Zomim could be punished, but his descendants cannot be punished. And in this particular case, since he himself being the Zaro of what? Of a kosher Kohen, he cannot say that, you know, they're
punished for it.
So therefore, what do we do? Give him Malkus. Okay. And
give the Eid Zomim Malkus.
Yeah, the Eid Zomim, right. Right. We're assuming that the Kohanim, you know.
Right.
Okay. In general, they should get malchus. That's you know, that goes without saying. But the point that they're making over here is that you cannot declare him as a punishment that he is now, from this point on, a ben grusha ben chalutza. That you can't do. That's all. Okay. Then the next one is v'yein golin lorin niklot, that you know, if they accuse someone of having committed accidental manslaughter, right? And and you know, the testimony is proven false, so we don't say that they
have to go
into the Orei Miklat. And there we gave a reason why. First of all, because the Torah says, Hu Yonus, in other words, the person who actually committed the murder, he is to flee to the Orei Miklat, you know, and find refuge over there so that the Goel Adam doesn't come after him. But also we learned another thing in connection with the Orei Miklat, and that is that the whole idea of the exile is to serve as what?
Kapara,
right, exactly. As an atonement, right? So, and this guy, we say, he doesn't deserve atonement, he's Eid Zomim. Because what he did deliberately in order to harm somebody else, and as a result, he does not deserve, you know, the opportunity for Kapara in this particular case. Okay?
He gets Malkus too.
Yeah, he gets Malkus. Right. The supposition in all these cases, you know, in these four things, is that they get loken. You know, in other words, they get malchus. They are flogged for having dared to do this kind of business. Okay? All right, then we came to the next case that they discussed. The Yein Mishalman is a kofer. They do not pay kofer. Remember, we took a look there at the Torah, and we saw that, you know, there are several cases where the judges have to make a decision. Of course, there are many cases, but specifically what I had in mind is that, first of all, if a person has an ox, and the ox is what we would call a tam. In other words, it has not been testified that this is a murderous ox. It has not gored previously. That only happens, you know, if it gores three times, then that case is called a muad.
Right.
Right, from, you know, the word, you know, edus, right? Muad. In other words, testimony has been given against this animal, okay? So, in this particular case, what has happened? The Torah says that, you know, if a person, you know, owns, you know, an ox which gores, then in that case, there is a punishment for the ox. And how about the owner? So technically the Torah says, you know, Gambo love you must, that the owner should be put to death. But then immediately in the next pasuk it says, Im kofa yusha salav, that if a ransom, so to speak, is placed upon him, in other words, to ransom him, you know, from the penalty of death, so that he has to give a monetary ransom for it, then in that case, you know, it's according kasha yushasalav. I mean, it's whatever the estimate is placed upon him. So this is where we're up to right now. Okay? And the fourth case is in the Columbia with Ivri. It's not to be sold as a Hebrew slave. And so, but this we're going to analyze now. Okay. And then Rabbi Akiva, right, Mishum Rabbi Akiva, or Mun, the name of Rabbi Akiva, they said, I'm Afe Misham and Api Atzman. All right. Now, we'll save the definitions because we'll take them phrase by phrase. Okay? So, the first phrase that they're going is, you know, yeah, I have to sometimes my eye, you know, wanders a little bit, right? Okay, yeah. All right. Okay. All right. So we already said that. And go on the Yorei Miklot, right? And then Mishalman is a koper. Why don't they pay the koper? Okay. So, Kosabre, because the opinion is that Kufra is kapora, right? In other words, the koper, okay? The ransom money, right, is also an atonement. As you can see, you know, the two words are related etymologically to each other. The Yahane love b'nei kapor ninu. And they are not people who, and I translated as deserve kapora. But I also told you that Rashi has a somewhat different angle, so we'll take a look at Rashi's angle right now. Okay? All right. All right. The Rashi you'll find roughly down around a little bit further where it says Ein Mishalman Kofa. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the margin you'll see it says Shom, and then you go down a few more lines and you see Ein Mishalman Kofa, right? So Rashi gives the following explanation. All right. It says Im Hei Idu B'Shoh Hamuad, right?
Okay.
If they testify against an ox which has already been declared a muad, in other words, one that is accustomed to goring. He's a mean-tempered ox, and whenever he sees a guy that he doesn't like, bingo, he
gores him.
Right, gores him. So, Rashi says that in that case, then, if they have testified, you know, against a shor muad, shehoragus odom, and they say that this ox killed a human being, right? The husbum. And then what happened? These Adam were declared false witnesses. Okay? Now, they would have required the owner of the ox to pay kofa, to pay a ransom, right? As the you know, as the pasuk says, kofa yushasalov, right? So then, all right, the next one that Rashi is doing is the Inim Korm, you know, that the ganav, they cannot be sold as ganavim, im heidi yuhu sheganav, right, v'yein l'mal shalem, if, you know, they testify that this man was a robber, and he doesn't have what to pay back, you know, to the person whom he has robbed, v'nigbar dino l'mochim, and then the court passes, you know, makes a ruling that, you know, he has to then be sold into slavery in order to pay off his debt. As the pasuk says, that he is to be sold, you know, for having committed this theft. So, you know, then in that case we said, you know, that nevertheless, Enim Zomim cannot be sold. Why? As I say, we'll have to go through the text and we'll see, you know, what basis they have for that. And then the last thing that that they quoted in the name of Rabbi Akiva as Ein Mishalman al Piyatzman, right? That they do not pay according to their own testimony. So what does that mean? So Rashi explains him. Who's Mubivezde? Let's say that they were in court A, okay? And in court A, where the original testimony was given concerning the person, you know, whom they falsely gave testimony against, let's call him Reuven if you wish, okay? All right, they testified falsely against Reuven. And what has happened? What happened is now, Velo is pig baldin la midim bedin al hazamason, and Reuven did not have a chance yet to hold them to the court that they should be punished, you know, that they should be judged. for having given false testimony against him. Ad Shebarchu, before these guys simply ran away. They disappeared from court, you know, the first court in which was.
The
okay.
Yeah,
the Zolomon. All right. And they fled. Uvova Bezdin Acher. And then afterwards they came to another Bezdin, Bezdin Beis, okay? The Hodu, and there they testified. They admitted, Shehuzman Bezdin Pleni, that they had, you know, right, that they had been false witnesses in Bezdin Aleph, right, Bezdin A. Then in that case, we say that they're not, you know, they're not going to pay according to their confession. The word, in other words, you have to go on a different basis. Why? We'll see in a moment. Okay. It says, they'll come first, and afterwards we'll give. All right, so now we come to the... yes.
According to Rashi, if the false witness, in a sense, does a vidui, if he goes into a second court and makes a statement that I gave false testimony...
Yeah, that's, we were proven to be Adam Zomim, that's the point. We were proven to be Adam Zomim in court A, okay? Yeah.
Right, okay, so he's proven to be, he's found to be.
Right.
Now he makes his admission in court.
He makes his admission, but not in the original court. He makes it in a different court.
Okay, different.
So the question is, right, then can the money that they would have assessed them, you know, in court A be collectible in court B? This is what the question is, according, you know, on their own confession. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but, you know, it's also a question of co-fair over here. The chances are that they could be forced to pay something.
Right.
But to what extent, you know, this would have to be determined. And, you know, and then you have another question, you know, namely, does court B have jurisdiction over a matter that should have been settled in court A?
It was the act of the vidui that would compel the payment of the kofir. That's what you're saying, because they're already found.
Yeah, would it?
Would it?
They have been proven in the other court that they were Adam Zomerman. But instead of facing the music,
they ran away.
They ran away.
Right.
Okay. So now, for some reason or other, they have charata.
Right.
And they come to another Bezdin, another place altogether, and they say, look, I mean, we were declared Adam Zomimin, and, you know, what do? We pay right now the kofar, in other words, the ransom money that, you know, we should have paid. So, according to Rabbi Akiva, it's Eim Misham Al Pi Atzma. In other words, you cannot compel them to pay the amount of money that they own simply on the basis of their confession. Okay. Why? Well, this we have to see how the text...
I guess that's what I'm getting at. In the original court, the Beit Din, they would have received Malkot.
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
Or they would have also been assessed. Maybe they wouldn't.
They
would have. They could have had a monetary assessment. Not necessarily Malkot. Depends, you know, what they accuse the person of doing. Because Adam Zomerman, I mean, the law of Adam Zomerman applies not just, you know, to capital cases or to cases, you know, which would involve, let's say, golus, you know, exile and things like that, but it applies also to monetary affairs, as we see. And monetary affairs, you have to go according to what does the Torah have to say about payments, and what did he try to deprive the person of? Because the idea is that if, you know, if it's tit for tat, so to speak, right? If the court would have said, okay, Reuven, let's say, has to pay $5,000, okay? Then in that particular case, if we find out that the testimony they gave against Reuven is false, then what are they expected to do?
$5,000.
Right, the court will say, you pay $5,000, because what you purpose to do, this is what your punishment is, okay?
What would happen if he didn't have the $5,000? Then he'd get the Malkus.
He would get Malkus, and maybe they would require him to sort of pay it off or something like that.
And he could sign
Bezdin has certain rights in order to try to enforce its authority, okay? I mean, today Jewish Bezdins have no authority. Only in Eretz Yisrael do they have somewhat of an authority, but, you know, it's being contested continually by the secular authorities.
Mm.
Don't have to tell you that the you know, the secular courts trying to reduce the area of jurisdiction of the Beis Din. Even in those matters, you know, where according to the original agreement, first with the British government, and then also probably even as a hangover, you know, from the days when the Turks were still ruling and so on, where the religious courts actually were the courts of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the modus vivendi that was reached was that in matters of marriage, divorce, and also inheritance, where, you know, the people say that they want to have judgment on inheritance based according to the law of the Torah rather than mm-hmm. on secular concepts. Okay? Then in those ideas it should be. But, you know, the civil court is trying to chop away everything. And, you know, they've launched a campaign again and again, you know, in order to deprive, for example, local religious councils of a certain aspect of their autonomy and things like that.
Excuse me, I don't mean to belabor this, but I just wanted to stay on this point just one more time. From what we have in the Gemara, before we get the Tehillim Shin, I don't know, maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but I thought that what was said here was that in the case where you had the question of the whatever, the gourd, whatever, that in that case the false witnesses would not pay kapora. Correct?
That depends on the point of view of whoever it may be. But the question is, correct. All right, let's come to the Rashi right now.
Rashi
all right, let's take a look at the Rashi.
All right, okay.
Because there's another sentence that we have to read.
All right,
okay? All right, it says Kufra Kapora, right?
Yep.
You see, there's a Machlekes. Take a look at the text of the Gemara again. You see that there is a difference of opinion, just a little bit down, a couple of more lines, okay? As to whether kofar is money, in other words, you have to, you know, is it simply purely a matter of monetary compensation, or is it kapara, which would involve already, you know, something, shall we say, like spiritual compensation as well, okay? So if you say it's only monetary compensation, well, that could be easily determined by a court. Okay, but if you say that it's also nosan pidyo nafsham, and you take it in the sense that this is in order to redeem his soul, rather than taking it in a different sense, namely that, you know, he has to make good what he's done, right? So in that case, then we said that, you know, they're not. So what?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Something?
What about what?
Word kaporos,
Yeah, absolutely,
that's
sure.
Kapara means...
Right. I mean, when you shlok kaparas, you know, what you're saying is, you know, that, you know, may this animal's death, you know, be an atonement for me, all right? Or may the money that I give to charity be an atonement for me. So that's why it's called
kaparas. But in
kaparas.
The meantime, what happens to the guy who got gored by the ox?
Unfortunately, he's dead. And this we have to determine now what's happening. Okay, all right? You raised a valid point. All right, so let's look at the Rashi.
We're worrying about the Eid Atonement, not about the...
All right, so Rashi continues...